This is Isabella Kaminska, and you are listening to Bitcoin Uncensored.
As the deer panteth o'er the water, so my soul longs to blockchain thee. You alone are my heart's desire, and I long to blockchain thee. You alone are my strength, my shield. To you alone may my blockchain yield. As the deer panteth o'er the water, Lord, I long to blockchain thee.
What's up, party people? This is Chris DeRose.
And this is Junseth.
And this interview is one we've been holding for a little while. We've been just courting with American Banker, making sure people get this news out. I think there's a lot of misinformation in the business right now regarding blockchains. I think there's a lot of good opinions that aren't being heard, and that is why we have Isabella Kaminska with us today.
Yeah, but her opinion's being heard.
You know what? I don't know.
She writes all the time, but you know what? She's a really excellent, she's very contentious. She's probably Bitcoiner number one, or Butt-coiner number one.
Her opinions are heard in general. I don't think that her very warranted skepticism, which I largely or entirely share, are being heard out of the rest of her message.
Right.
So my hope is that with this discussion,
she's,
we can bring
she's
more
less
sanity.
Of a human to all of us. She's more just like an internet robot.
So what's going to follow here is a conversation we had, 2 weeks ago now at the time of this airing.
Mm-hmm.
And why don't you take a listen, see what you think, and we'll be back with you after the break.
Sure. Bye.
All right. So with us today is Isabella Kaminska of the Financial Times. She is she's noteworthy, certainly outside of our own space. Isabella, welcome to the show. Tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
I'm a journalist. I've always been a financial journalist. I studied ancient history and journalism and focused a lot on propaganda. And that's about it, really.
Where did you study?
At University College London.
Oh, okay. I've never been to Europe. Chris has been to Europe. He likes it very much.
I have. I've been to London a few times. Wonderful city. And what is it that in your background that particularly has led you to FT? Because were you, in fact, in the banking industry for a while, or have you just been covering it at length for so long that you know the ins and outs pretty well?
I haven't been ever in banking. I've always been an outsider, but I've always been fascinated with the history of money. And like I said, I was an ancient historian, so I focused a lot on early money, Roman coinage, Diocletian's era, etc. And I've always been fascinated with ancient economies, and I ended up inevitably being pulled into covering financial economics as well.
What kind of leads you to that, Isabel? Like, why? How did you kind of acquire that interest? Because that's a pretty esoteric sort of interest.
That's really hard question to answer. I don't know. I just was always interested in how things work and what's behind the scenes. And I distinctly remember being about 7 years old in the car and my mother trying to bribe me with something and giving me some measly pounds and thinking, why is this more valuable than the sweets that I got? I don't understand why I should have this coupon.
Yeah.
So that's kind of from that moment on, I always wondered about it.
That makes sense. Chris and I actually talk a lot about that. Chris will walk 2 or 3 miles for one beer, but he won't do it for the $2 to buy the beer.
Yeah, I don't know why. Well, anybody who listens to our show is probably of a similar mindset. Money is something that we spend a lot of time discussing, and it's a really subtle and often confusing subject matter. Isabella, do you have a definition of money that you like to espouse?
You know, I think it's very dangerous to present anything close to a definition of money, because I think money is slightly subjective, and I think it means different things to different people. But my personal preference is that money is both forward-looking and backward-looking. So it's about it's a rationing system wherein we track and understand who's created value in the economy to ensure that people who have done so can be rewarded for it within a sharing economy, and then also ensure that the capital that has been created doesn't go to waste. And we reallocate that to other people, and that creates credit. And I think money without credit is is bad. And I think credit without also being able to prove and track where the value comes from is also bad. So it's a balance.
What would you – do you see there to be a difference between money and commodities, or is it purely like the ability to spend, value density or something like that?
Well, I think commodities are something that are a resource in the economy, which you can either put to use productively or you can waste. And just having commodities is not in any shape or form tantamount to having money, because commodities that don't have any value add are kind of redundant. So you still need labor and you still need all these other factors of production to actually produce things that people want, because you can't eat, unrefined ores and all that sort of stuff. So commodities in and of themselves are just a means towards creating a civilization. I mean, fundamentally, it's about civilization and about organized society. And you need — the problem with civilization, from my perspective, is that you need a settled society that collaborates and that knows its place in the system so as to maximize the resources it has and the energy. And that's all very well, and it can be very prosperous, but it kind of infringes on your liberty, because nobody likes to be a cog in a machine. And so you end up with this sort of conflicting situation where you create prosperity by acting in unison with your fellow man, but at the same time you resent your fellow man because you're, not doing the bit that you want to be doing, whatever. So my point is simply that civilization is the result of this collaborative process. And without collaboration, you can't have civilization. You have nomadic chaos. Everyone has to be a nomad. Everyone has to work for themselves. You have to be a jack of all trades because you can't depend on society. So with the fruits of civilization comes an inevitable restriction and some liberty. And it's about how we balance those two, which creates a healthy environment for all of us. Does that make sense?
Certainly.
It makes sense. So, Isabel, one of the questions I would have for you is, what do you consider yourself politically? Like, we tend to come from a background here being, Bitcoiners of any sort. From a weird anarchist perspective, we see a lot of anarchists day to day and participate a lot in those circles. And I hear a lot of what you're saying. I know that you're like a fan of Noam Chomsky and other such people. So like, where would you say you're on the political spectrum? Where would you put yourself?
I would say I'm on the firmly agnostic side of the political spectrum, because I consider myself neutral, and I consider myself open to either perspective if the logical argument makes sense. But at the same time, I also subscribe to the theory of endocyclosis, which is that systems are constantly in flux and are totally dynamic. And the solution that makes sense at one particular time doesn't necessarily make a different time. So one has to adjust the solution according to the circumstances. So I think one size fits all politics is quite naive. I think one has to be somewhat liberal-minded in the sense, in our English sense of the word liberal, not in your sense, that you adjust yourself, because the economy in our society is constantly under the influence of different factors.
You might be an anarchist, Isabella. I hate to tell you.
Or maybe an anarcho-millenarist. myself.
She's a hat if she's going to be an anarcho-millenarist.
I don't think it's not anarcho, because I subscribe to the idea of government, and I think government is absolutely necessary in some cases. Yeah, as any historian, it's really the story of Star Wars, isn't it? It's like the continuous battle between fair representation and oppression, and these forces are constantly, they're cyclical. They're like, so you can't be anarchic, because then you have chaos and you have no order, and you have this idea that Darwinian, the guy you had as a Darwinian sort of economic allocation tournaments are right. That's not technically true, because what we have is the force of game theory and so forth continuously wiping out those who organize versus those who don't organize.
Well,
so if you're organized, you have an advantage in society.
I don't disagree with that at all. I think our brand of anarchy does not preclude the government from existing. It very well may be that in an anarchic world, people collude and organizations form, and before you know it, I mean, this is what anarchy might look like, is in fact some form of government. But I don't know. We're constantly asking ourselves just what we are. So maybe we are an anarchist after all. We really don't know. What do you think, Josh?
I never know either. But to me, Isabella, I'm with you. We would describe what we generally ascribe to sort of a null hypothesis sort of thing. Like we try to come at things neutrally and understand them from a very neutral perspective. And you know, we fail sometimes.
The only thing I'm sure of is that I don't believe in absolutism, because I think being absolutist about anything is not very, you know, forward thinking in any shape or form. So I always, you know, even my entire philosophical history, whatever I write, I'm always changing my mind. And people might call me a hypocrite. I think that's actually how you learn and how you evolve.
So it sounds like my favorite quote. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. Like Chris.
Hobgoblin number one over here.
Nice quote.
Thank you. It's Ralph Waldo Emerson.
So, Isabella, can you tell us a little bit about some of the work you've been doing the last year? You've been doing stuff with MMM. And the Mavrati stuff, which I think is really kind of it's very topical because it's affected the Bitcoin price. But can you talk a little bit about the history there and, you know, how that's kind of, you know, working itself into Bitcoin even now, maybe?
So Sergey Mavrati, is a fascinating guy with a really interesting history. And he first came on the scene at the fall of communism in the 1990s, when everyone in Russia really didn't have a clue about what a market economy was or what investments were. And so they were really like vulnerable stock in terms of being exploited by a Ponzi schemer. And he made these very compelling adverts on Russian TV. And he himself was a engineer and a computer scientist. I believe he has a degree in artificial intelligence from one of the Russian universities. So he came across and he sold this story about how if you invest in a Ponzi scheme, you can definitely have positive returns. It's just a question of controlling the money supply. And it grew exponentially, and the security, you know, the officials took note and they shut him down, and he then blamed them for collapsing the Ponzi. He said, you know, he still in his mind was under the impression that the Ponzi could have lived forever if not for the intervention of the government. And to cut a long story short, he was arrested or threatened with arrest. The investors were all upset. They were desperate to get their money back. And he, in a genius stroke, told them to elect him to the Duma, because that way he would have political exceptions. And he would also have the ability to use the government budget to pay them back. Genius, right? You can just imagine Donald Trump doing something like that.
This is great.
So, and then they did elect him, and then he lost his political immunity because obviously nobody wanted him to do that. And through some sort of Russian process, they finally kicked him out, and he ended up in prison. And he was released, I believe. Don't quote me, but it was just after the crisis, I think, the 2008 crisis, and he, or maybe just before, somewhere around then, and he went straight into developing new Ponzi schemes. And this time, with the power of the internet, he was able to really sell the concept. And he targets, as Ponzi schemers often do, very vulnerable sort of societies in emerging markets that don't have much familiarity with how markets work. He operates through word of mouth. He also sells, you know, unbelievable sort of narratives to go alongside this, you know, connected with the end of the financial system as we see it. And he's written a couple of books. There's one called Lucifer's Son, which, you know, he's very enterprising in that sense and imaginative and creative. So that's really the story of Mavrodi. And where he is now is that...
He sounds to me like the Pablo Escobar of money.
That's a really good way of describing him. I think he really is. He's like a Robin Hood figure who is, on one hand, I mean, he claims to not personally profit from any of his Ponzi schemes. And because they're actually social, well, he calls them pyramids. He calls them social, mutual aid societies, social finance networks where... you know, they're all bilateral relationships, so you can't shut him down. Everyone, and when you, if you try to join the scheme, there's a waiver where you have to pledge that you're doing this in sound body and mind, you know. So, but there have been like local jurisdictions that have tried to shut him down, but then there are others that have been really struggling. And now, of course, this is where Bitcoin comes in. Because back in the day, he used to issue his own currency. It was the Mavrod, or Mavro, the Mavro. And really, in many ways, it was very similar to Bitcoin, apart from the cryptographic stuff. He was the central distribution agent of Mavros. But in terms of it being a parallel currency. And he has now moved to a global scheme where he has forsaken the Mavros, and he's now encouraging people to use Bitcoin. And this has been going on for about 2 years, maybe a year and a half, really. And when you talk to him, and I haven't directly corresponded with him because he speaks in Russian, but when you, through our proxy translation agent, he claims that it's quite clear that the Bitcoin price is 100% controlled by him at this point.
That's a very bold claim. And do you believe that claim?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's hard to know because obviously he doesn't offer his own financial statements, does he? So we don't know how big his Ponzi scheme is or how many people are involved. But what you can do is monitor anecdotal evidence, which is based on all these videos that are submitted to YouTube endorsing the scheme and trying to encourage other people to join. And there are thousands and thousands of those. And those are just on the English YouTube. So if you consider that there are all sorts of local language ones that don't get picked up, it is quite a phenomenal... It is a big scheme. Now, logically, I think there is definitely an influence on the price. And when you hear anecdotal reports from exchanges, they too are now... I mean, I think it's penetrated the market. Like, it's gone... before, I think the Bitcoin community... This is my perception. Before, the Bitcoin community would have thought that was a benefit to them. But really, I think now there's a sort of awakening that this is a big problem, and like we should be upfront about how much of the flow is coming from this pyramid scheme, because it doesn't really do a lot to legitimize Bitcoin.
Bitcoin has lots of problems. I don't even know that that's one of the one of the bigger ones, but you're certainly correct. You know, we watch a lot of the activity on Bitcoin. We can't really figure out what's going on and where. I want to study a little bit more of what's going on with the local exchangers to get a better idea.
Bitcoiners always want to know that.
The truth is that very few Bitcoiners actually use Bitcoin. That a lot of the Bitcoin is used by people that are probably outside of the Reddit community and outside of the communities that even we frequent, which are primarily composed of speculators in Bitcoin, which it is what it is. A lot of people criticize that, and they're probably not wrong to do so. Now, you know, why do you think that there are so many scams in Bitcoin? Like, I have my answers, but it's obvious that it's inundated with scams. Why and how would you explain that to be the case?
So I have a relatively controversial theory that I think most people will immediately jump on and go, you're totally wrong. But my personal perception is that with Bitcoin, we lose the double entry accounting system. So one of the reasons we had this amazing explosion in wealth and civilization around the Renaissance time was because of the invention of double entry and via Luca Pacioli, basically. And he, what he understood is that for every asset, there has to be a liability. And if you don't have this balancing process, you don't really know where your money is being allocated or whether it's going to return value to you. Now, a lot of people say Bitcoin is a triple entry accounting system, but I think they're kind of abstracting it to the point where they've missed out the point that in every central banking system that's ever been, the balance of payments is essential. And the balance of payments is the system that actually, like as per the Luca Pacioli system, it tells you how much value there is in the economy. That's why banks, central banks, always take collateral and they issue liquidity against collateral. So the idea is that in a liquidity crunch, there's always some underlying value that you can prove it's collateralized. Here are a bunch of houses or whatever, blah, blah, blah. Bitcoin doesn't do this. Bitcoin instead takes capital or money, wealth, whatever, dollars, and it assigns it to a network where we have no paper, I mean, ironically, we have no paper trail as to how it's invested. So we don't know whether the miners who are getting the opportunity to cash out against dollars are using those dollars to invest in more Bitcoin mining machines, whether they're using it to buy Tesla cars, or whether they're using it to buy houses, or to invest in, like, I don't know, solar renewable plants. We just don't have that other side of the balance sheet.
Well, why does that matter?
Because if you have no reinvestment of capital, the nature of capital is that it depreciates, right? If you consume, if you just consume and you don't put back what you've taken, eventually you will have a rundown house, right? You will have, a dirty car. You will have, depreciation is a real thing, right? That's why the sharing economy via the banking sector came up in the first place. Because idle capacity, if you just leave it there and you don't look after it, it will get, you need to maintain it and you need to upgrade it. And you ideally want to invest even more of it so as to grow society and make wealth. Now, with Bitcoin, there is no such, there isn't an allocation system that encourages people to reinvest the Bitcoin in productive ventures. And because of that, as per Mavrodi, Mavrodi's the same, you just drain the working capital that is available to you and you don't put it back.
So this would be
cash burn. Well, you know, when you talk about VCs and cash burn.
Right. So this would be like the World Bank claiming that Bitcoin is a natural Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds very much like a Ponzi scheme allegation of sorts. Although I have to think about it because I haven't quite heard it verbalized in those terms. It also sounds like you believe that, in fact, and this despite some people's claims, Bitcoin is fairly anonymous. And I know there's this weird rift where some people say that Bitcoin is completely transparent, and then others who like yourself, I believe, and certainly like us, believe that it's fairly anonymous. Is that, in fact, your view that it is a fairly anonymous and not transparent process?
I think it has both features in many way. Like, it's anonymous until, like, someone desperately tries to use the power of Columbo to figure out, you know, which wallet is yours. Once there's a link between a wallet and you, it becomes fairly non-anonymous because you can then, it's almost the opposite at that point. At that point, it becomes like, you know, the vigilantism of like following, you know, you see that in the community all the time. Like when people are like, oh, these stolen funds, we can track them through the system really well. And also there's the other factor that you don't know how these transfers are occurring. So I go to a shop and I buy, you see, this is again, you only see one part of the balance sheet. You see the transfer of the unit, but you don't see what it's being transferred against. So I go to a shop, I buy a coffee, that's a legitimate transaction, and it's not going to have a chargeback, whatever. We've settled in Bitcoin, and it's great. But if someone's stolen my Bitcoin and then uses my Bitcoin to buy a coffee, that's not a legitimate transaction because it was not their Bitcoin to take in the first place. And then you have the issue of, well, I thought I had a Bitcoin, but someone else spent it because they stole it from me. And I still have a claim on the system. I have a claim on that Bitcoin, but so does the merchant who accepted it. So you have a double claim now. So this, even though you have this finite pool of Bitcoins, which can never grow, you don't know how many people think they have double claims on it, if you know what I mean.
But
does that make sense?
It does make sense. But so you're suggesting that when Bitcoin is stolen, which happens all the time, that we don't have the ability to really track who, where, and how things transact from there. Is that a good boil down view, or did I miss that?
Well, It's more that because it's a bearer instrument, once it passes hands, you, if it's to be treated as a bearer instrument, like with cash, as soon as I get cash, it doesn't matter where it's come from, it's mine. And any history, any dirty history that's associated with cash is out of picture. Now, financial institutions try very hard to actually limit that by creating KYC rules, anti-money laundering rules. So it's becoming harder and harder to get that dirty cash circulating as if it was a fungible, you know, equivalent to the clean cash, right? With Bitcoin, though, you don't have, you know, there is this kind of legal question as to whether if you can prove that your Bitcoin was your, like someone stole it from you and this was your stock, will, in legal terms, is it, if, even if it ends up at some coffee merchant, is it theirs or is it yours? You'd have to take it to a legal sort of proceeding and then have a debate about, you know, whose it really is. And it becomes very complex.
But Isabel, how is that any different than, like, any bearer instrument or any sort of stolen item? You know, what's the phrase? Well, possession is 9/10 of the law?
But yes, but with cash, actually, the rules state very clearly that cash doesn't, like, has no history. So once cash moves around, it doesn't matter where you can. And that's what makes it fungible and liquid, right? So
sure.
If Bitcoin is to be treated like a security, which a lot of people actually think it should, then you limit its fungibility, because then all those legacy claims actually really matter. If it's to be treated as a cash bearer instrument, well, then you encounter the same problem that the real economy is encountering, which is that actually not being able to trace illegitimate transactions is really bad for the health of the economy.
We believe that Bitcoin...
Does that make sense?
It certainly does. We believe that Bitcoin is probably not fungible enough, but that therein lies its utility. And then my question would be, if in fact the fungibility improves, which is on the roadmap and it is being actively developed, then would you believe that Bitcoin adds utility, or would you at that point believe that it is a net detriment to our economic environment, and in that sense is no longer a efficiency?
So what, you guys believe that it should be less fungible?
No, more fungible.
More fungible.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, and there are proposals on the table to make it quite a bit more fungible with, like, confidential transactions.
CoinJoin.
CoinJoin, stuff like that. So basically mixing and the inability to identify the person from whom it's being spent and where it's going, and in addition to that, the inability to see the amounts that are spent. So those there are proposals on the table to obfuscate both, which would essentially eliminate their history.
Right. So my position on that is, again, I mean, I'm sorry to drone on, but, like, it's fairly complex, because I think both situations give you positives and negatives. So generally speaking, cash is a really important thing in society because it allows for something called freedom of choice, right? So you end up with a... you know, there are, and privacy, and it's important because it's about feeling like you might be able to change your mind and you're not committed to any one path with how you spend your money. That's cash. But on the other hand, if you have too much cash, you open the door to insecurity in the system. So there's something called the civilization prosperity security paradox, which sounds really complex.
Yeah, really.
But it's fairly easy, which is that if you spend more time securing your wealth than actually creating the wealth, well, you're in a negative net situation. You end up destroying civilization because you're spending more money securing your pot of gold than you are able to, like, the economic value is... It's basically uneconomic. It's like Concord. Concord was not economic, right? And that's really the same problem with cash. So cash is great in an organized system where we have moral values and we all wake up in the morning, we do our role, and then we enjoy that little bit of liberty that we're entitled to, and we have a bit of privacy and everything's fairly balanced. But cash is a real problem in an economy where the overall size of the pie is contracting, because it encourages predatory it abuses that civil liberty for bad, right? And then if you get too many predators and not enough doves, cooperative doves, well, that drains wealth from society and actually creates a kind of negative feedback loop. So does that make sense?
Isabel, you recently wrote an article called "The Time for Official E-Money Is Now," right?
Mm-hmm.
Not recently. It's actually a year old. do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because, I mean, it seems to me that you have advocated in the past for a cashless society, right?
Yes, and I have since totally changed my mind.
Okay.
So I think... So what changed my mind, so before I thought it would be a fantastic solution to have digital money because it would allow A, central banks to do negative interest rates, it would allow society to track everything and all these wonderful economically efficient things. And a lot of the bankers really think this. They think if we ban cash, all the problems of society go away. But then my colleague Chris Giles wrote a very good piece sort of explaining why cash is important and how without it you completely abandon your ability to be private and to have this freedom of choice.
Well, I mean,
and then what I realized as well.
Doesn't that eliminate fungibility? Like, doesn't cashlessness eliminate fungibility?
Absolutely. So it creates a sort of mini command economy where everybody has economic planning. Nothing is fungible, so there is no liquidity. Everything has to be predetermined by some sort of algorithm or that is reading your mind and making terrible presumptions about your behavior, like my iPhone always presumes what I want to write and I hate it. And this is like the same problem that the communists system encountered when it tried to plan its economy. And so you need this like fungible sort of standard base unit, which may be both you being used for good, but it may also be being used for bad. But you need it because it's the voting machine for the market. And if without that voting machine, my instinct is that you end up potentially misallocating resources based on some people's presumptions of what people want you to have rather than what you really want to have, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Isabel, I would also suggest, though, that I think people are pretty creative at finding fungible tokens of value. In the States here, we have a number of drug dealers accepting Tide bottles as a mechanism of payment.
And that goes back as far as Vietnam, by the way.
The Tide bottles?
Oh, no, and I totally agree, which is one of the other reasons I changed my mind, is that I think it's a stupid ambition to try and do a cashless society because money is endogenous and people will find alternative bearer instruments. You can't ban people from giving each other credit. The mafia has always used art. They've used classic cars. They've used, at the end of the day, anything can be made into an alternative. So it's just, the problem comes with the interaction with the cleared economy. So if you're using a parallel network that is fungible for your own network, either your network is creating value in and of itself, so you never need to interact with that other network, which is great because then you have a functional economy, or you have to find a gate to swap your value unit for the value units of the cleared economy that you want entry to. And that's where the frictions come in. The frictions come in between the different value networks.
So
I totally agree. You'll always have, and funnily enough, I have a feeling that if you banned cash, what would happen is quite counterintuitive. You would end up creating a parallel
Bitcoin
network, which would end up being, I think it would, I don't think it, see, I have, I don't think it's Bitcoin because of other reasons, but hypothetically, if it was a central, if it was a netting-based sharing economy one with a double-sided ledger, then you would maybe bring back capitalistic spirit and the incentive to invest in productive enterprise, which would be very good.
Are you a fan of private monies? Is that something you like, or is that just outdated and stupid now that we have central banks?
Well, I would argue we already have private money. So I think it's a massive fallacy that we have fiat money, because fiat money is only a tiny part of the money supply, right? So what we have is a system of liabilities. And And actually what you have is a hierarchy of money. So you have base money, which is the most liquid money because it's government-issued money, but you also have HSBC money or Morgan's, you know...
And HSBC...
JP Morgan money.
HSBC money or JP Morgan money, are you talking about their essentially the risk pool of their, you know, holding money, or are you talking about the debts that they actually issue against their banks?
I think the latter.
I would assume the latter, but I'm not sure.
I'm talking about their liabilities. So every time, so a central bank, think of the best way I would, the way it was explained to me by someone much smarter than me, was that the central bank doesn't want to have to share its balance sheet with the entire global economy, because that would be really inefficient. It would have to fund all the like checking of every single transaction in society. So it outsources that job to licensed institutions that share its values, who operate as sort of on the next tier down, and they operate their, you know, they clear transactions in their little area of the woods, and all those things, all those liabilities are their money. So they issue money, and now as soon as you create another layer, you kind of create, introduce a new intermediary, and that creates risk because you have to trust that those networks are doing the job to your own standards. And so the risk there is that these outsourced entities abuse that power and overissue money to the wrong people in society that don't create value. And then there's a capital constraint at the heart of the economy, and you end up having a financial crisis. But fundamentally, all these different systems end up being a cartel for the sake of fungibility. Because if you had to go to the shop and clear with JP Morgan money, which is valued not at par value, but at minus, you know, 10% of par value, because they're not doing very well with their asset pool. But then you have, you know, the shopkeeper gives you change in Bank of America money, which is par value plus 10% or whatever. There would be confusion. There wouldn't be, you know, one of the great things about society is synchronicity, and we have civilization spring up at the moment we find ways to synchronize people, whether it's time or whether it's meters and measurements, apart from you guys in America who insist on using miles.
Right.
Of course.
So, yeah.
America's better.
No, I'm not arguing that one.
We like America's better.
But anyway, so that you have all. So the reason they need to ensure par value, they need to ensure a fungible unit, and so the, how do they do that? They cross insure each other, and so they end up cross insuring each other. So if I'm ever in deficit or my assets aren't really, I can't pull the liquidity out of them today, so and so lends them the money, and before you know it, you have this fungible unit based on self-insurance, and it's actually a private network solution. Like, well, one of the things that really annoys me is that people moan about FIRE. It's private. I mean, it really annoys me because in this space, you constantly hear, oh, fiat money is government, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is that you also hear this other conspiracy theory about how the Federal Reserve is a private bank. So which one is it?
It's a good point.
Well, we're with you here. I mean, the reality is when I look at something like long-term treasury rates, I see that they're selling at something like 3%, right? And that 30 years is a little lengthy for any sort of real good indication. But the reality is that like the market is betting that the economy here on the U.S. side is going to go 3%, 2%, whatever it is. And the Fed does a really decent job, despite all of the levers involved in creating creating either inflation or deflation. They do a really good job of keeping it right around 2% to 3% a year. It's pretty hard to argue with. So, you know, my question for you, would you say then that like FDIC insurance, as we have in the United States, is what allows a person, when they receive a fungible token of value, you know, a $1 bill, to go from one bank to another, you know, like essentially like Chase USD? Why Chase USD, despite maybe having a worse balance sheet or whatever the case is, or a higher risk, would be able to be exchanged for a Bank of America USD? Is that the result of that is FDIC insurance, right? I mean, that's why you can do that?
Absolutely. And we have it because without that layer of cover, you end up with risk that causes instability, volatility, and people panic, and you have terrible sort of bank runs and instability, right? So we've created this system of self-insurance to de-risk people enough so that they feel confident enough with their units to go and presume they're all worth roughly the same thing as everybody else's unit. And we use prices instead to deviate. Like, prices are the indicator we use instead to tell us what's performing and not and what isn't performing. So we presume a standard here, and it's self-insured, and it de-risks the economy. Bitcoin doesn't have this, by the way, which is one of the reasons why it's so volatile.
Well, this goes to one of our points too, again, and I want to get your opinion on it. We talk about government serving the function of normalizing risk in society, which I think is I think its main functions when we talk about government would be, one, normalizing risk, and two, taking care of externalities, which might actually be the same
function.
It's
the same thing,
so
I think.
What would you say about that? And Chris, what were you going to say?
I said it's the same thing, I think. I don't think there's a difference.
Yeah, I think they're the same.
Well, yeah, and I think that's a fair point. That's exactly what it does. I mean, government is there to take the spending decisions that the private sector won't spend because the profits are either too long-term away, like too far away, or the incentives are not there. So you see government having to... I mean, I'm a European, so it's very different for me, but, like, you know, the NHS is something that we take absolutely as gospel here in the UK, because it's a public social right, and we fund it through the de-risking swing transfer of money, but we all pay our little contribution via our tax system, and the smoothing effect of the insurance side of it is distributed by the government, and that's how, you know, at the end of the day, the bigger the entity, the bigger the diversification in society that it can manage, and a diversified insurance pool is the most efficient insurance pool because you have the most diversity in it.
You would acknowledge it is more expensive for the young people and much less expensive for the old people, right? It normalizes the cost over your lifetime.
Yeah, it's a consumption smoothing effect, and you end up smooth. But generally speaking, the government is really well placed to do that because it's captured the biggest, you know, population size, right? So it has the most diversity in its client pool, whereas like an insurer like Aviva or whatever, well, they're only as diversified as their clients, and that's going to already skew some of the issues because, you know, maybe only rich people take out insurance, or maybe only unhealthy people take out insurance, you know, so the government is actually in many ways more diversified risk transfer entity than an insurance firm.
So, we don't generally talk about healthcare, but I mean, just to put myself out there, I tend to agree that is something that, like, is de-riskable. And it seems – the reason I say that, and I generally talk about this in terms of, like, health outcomes and how those are quasi-random. Like, you can take care of yourself and be a perfectly healthy person and then find out that you have $1 million cancer bill in spite of doing everything you possibly can to avoid that, and saving and having insurance and all of that. So, like, that seems to me to be the kind of thing that we as a society should care about. Even despite the NHS's problems and whatever it has. So, but Chris, so what's next, Chris? What did you want to ask?
I want to talk a little bit about the sort of the blockchain movement, because I think Isabella's been a little skeptical of that, and certainly I'm very skeptical of that. She probably doesn't know my position on the matter, but I find it to be a bit of a dubious promise. In my mind, what blockchains do are provide bearer assets, typically, or even when done well, fungible bearer assets online. And it seems like there has been, in just a massive amount of hype, the inclination to take that innovation and turn it into something that it isn't. And that's where I think we're at. But I'd like to hear what Isabella thinks about the blockchain movement, what her thoughts are.
Yeah, well, I completely agree with you. I think banks are in a pickle because banks have depended on computers. Well, this is controversial, but like banks have to a large degree turn towards what are called real-time gross settlement systems, because they de-risk the system. They thought they de-risked the system. And they got into a lot of trouble in 2008 because those systems weren't as de-risked as they thought they were. And one of the reasons was that actually when you use collateral as a buffer for risk, you have to be pretty sure that the collateral standards are quite high. And of course, what happened is that, you know, what we know the story about subprime securities, etc. Banks were creating collateral that was not necessarily as high quality as we thought it was. And so how that feeds into the blockchain thing is that in 2008, an RTGS system is a very brittle system. It depends on sequential value transfer, which is never going to be as efficient as a netting system, which matches off different people's... So netting is a credit sort of system, and real-time gross is a sequential... We follow every single thing in society, like every transfer, blah, blah, blah. And it's really energy intensive. But because of computer speed times coming down, it was suddenly seen as efficient. But the reality is, compared to the liquidity saving opportunity with netting, I mean, real-time gross is really inefficient. And so they are now in a pickle because when 2008 struck, they had to basically not trust anybody in the banking network, and they had to double check everything themselves. They couldn't depend on the central clearing system at all because nobody knew the real value of any of the underlying collateral. And ever since then, they have really not much has changed. They're still having to double up on all those back office processes because you just, if you don't, you run the risk of having someone else take advantage of your liquidity situation, right?
So we hear that a lot about back office stuff, by the way. So that is true. There's just tons and tons of people in back office rechecking and checking everything.
Yeah. And this has got worse since 2008. I'm very long-winded, but that's basically the point. So here comes blockchain, and it's like, oh, we can get rid of all this chaos. You can just have a streamlined process, and it'll be brilliant. And you can have the best of both worlds. You can de-risk the system, and you can have a lower cost system, and blah, 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 blah. So naturally, they're going to be very inclined to do that because they're spending so much money on back office. Anything that promises them to reduce those back office costs, they're going to do it. The reason I'm skeptical of it is, A, blockchain, private blockchains are not necessarily going to reduce those back office costs for them. Secondly, they kind of bastardize the whole point of the blockchain in the first place because it's just using it for a cartel kind of stat. So you need standards, and the blockchain is, it's a one size fits all thing. Either they all do it or none of them do it, because if you have you can't have interoperable blockchains because you're back to the friction point that I referred to earlier. So you either have a monopolistic sort of everyone goes on the same blockchain, and that's impossible, and even governments can't force banks to adopt standards very quickly, right?
You also have some weird realities where, like, questions of immutability enter, right? Like, how immutable is this blockchain?
I don't know that they even care about that, Genzeth.
They don't want it to be immutable because, from their perspective, right, they have to have the chance to override transactions that they perceive as being fraudulent. So that's right. The other issue with it is that they want to have the feature of having the ability to reverse transactions, but they don't want the security risk. And the issue is that I'm not sure those two things are mutual. I mean, I think if you have the ability to reverse transactions, you introduce security risk. So you can't have both. It's unclear to me that you can have both.
Now,
I'm not a technical-minded person, but I think as soon as you allow any bank, whatever the process is, to habitually reverse transactions, that's going to be dependent on a human function somewhere in the system, and that introduces the risk that you will get. I mean, the vulnerability is always with the human, right?
Right, and I will say this: in our arguments with people, we've always heard the same phrase. One, Chris and I don't know anything about banking, which is true. We're idiots. But number two, that banks trust each other. So, will you please dispel that myth? Because I don't think it's true.
I think banks used to trust each other, but they don't anymore. And I think one of the reasons for this big change that happened in the 90s when they went from netting sort of all their transactions, which was a credit-based system based on trust, to using real-time gross settlement systems, which was like the Bitcoin of its day for banks.
Sure.
Because it allowed them to think that it was just foolproof. And so since then, they're like confused, and either they have to rebuild trust mechanisms, but they don't want to do that because they actually don't. They quite like not trusting each other.
Right.
That's more you know, admirable. So that's why they're interested in blockchain. But then the problem with a private blockchain is that actually a private blockchain is based on trust. So you can't have both. You can't have your cake and eat it.
Isabel, could you explain to me at what point did banks decide to share all of their transactions with each other without any sort of restriction? It seems like part of the push for this whole blockchain movement is for everybody to open up everyone's books with each other, but that doesn't seem like it would be in the interest of anybody who's a larger player than a smaller player. That information would typically be proprietary and worth trading on. At what point has that changed? Do you think that they just don't realize that that's their pitch?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the other problem. And I think that, you know, that creates market signal problems, and it creates all sorts of adverse selection issues. And I completely agree. I don't think you can have full transparency because you end up with gridlock in the system, because if it's neutral, it's not liquid. And if it's liquid, it's not neutral. And total transparency is supposedly neutral, but it's not liquid, because you immediately see people and you profile them and you discriminate against them and you won't like do business with this guy because I know he's done this and blah, blah, blah. And it's what I would call the unimatrix zero problem, right? So I don't know if you watch Star Trek, but, you know, the Borg are all knowing. And what happens is that the Borg actually create their own little dark pocket of the their little realm where they can hang out in total secrecy from the hive mind. And that's what happens. It's called the Stiglitz paradox. And it's this idea that you can never have full transparency because you always then create an incentive to create a dark pocket somewhere. And I think that's been proven when you look at what's happened with with public exchanges and dark pools and etc., and the rise of increased fragmentation, and actually the rise of even more predatory agents in between the different networks. So I think it's a bit of a pipe dream.
And I believe you've thrown out the theory that perhaps like the initiative, the R3 initiative, it is a form of regulatory arbitrage in the sense that regulators could be coerced into relaxing some regulations under this rubric of blockchain. Do you think that that's the overall play here, or do you think that that maybe is not the case and that they're just inordinately dumb?
Who knows? I mean, I think at the moment, anything that can reduce the regulatory reach is attractive to banks. It's not a good time to be a bank. It's a terrible time to be a bank. So if you can operate as a non-bank but still get the benefits of banking services, then that's the ideal situation, which is why they're so obsessed with the fintech movement in general, which is a kind of, in my opinion, backdoor option to, it's a loophole for like having your cake and eat it, which is, you know, operating, they can't afford to operate in high risk areas. So if you use a proxy, which is, you know, you invest in some fintech firm, well then you kind of get to have that cake and eat it.
That makes sense. A lot of these fintech plays seem to be within some form of regulatory arbitrage mechanism in terms of its efficiency. So I don't know that people are as open about that as they should be. But maybe that's the nature of regulatory arbitrage, is to keep that on the low. So, you know, I think I want to bring this back to Bitcoin just a little bit here. I think it's Junseth's view, and I know it's my view, that Bitcoin is finding its utility in censored markets and in markets that are being underserviced online. And, of course, that has been the darknet markets, which is principally drugs. What is your view, then, on that utility. Do you see that as not a utility because it does not fit squarely within the regulatory guidelines, or do you just find that to be a small growth capacity, given that the regulatory guidelines will probably change going forward and these markets will become less attractive?
I think the problem is the blurring of the lines. Like, if you had a totally segregated society that used Bitcoin, like if you all took all the Bitcoiners and put them on an island and had them like work in a, you know, operate in a sort of Peter Thiel dream of, or of the Google, like, you know, innovation state with no regulation, then I'd be very interested to watch that experiment take place.
We are watching it, right? It's where 16-year-olds give their money to people who ask them for it for bad projects.
Yeah, but no,
yeah.
That's what will happen on the island, you know.
But Isabel's point is a good one. I mean, we believe that if drugs were legal tomorrow, it would probably be that Bitcoin dies tomorrow. That the miners,
right,
if in fact those transactions are in fact drug transactions, if it's MMM, then what would happen is if MMM died tomorrow, then the mining would die tomorrow. So, like, maybe it wouldn't die completely, but it would go from $1 million a day down to, you know, $10,000 a day, or yeah, right. And
you mentioned Pablo Escobar, and Pablo Escobar was economically like one of the, you know, at his peak, he was a, he was worth more than most of the most of the companies in Colombia. I mean, his net worth was crazy compared to them. And what he had, like what any economic agent has to have, is something other people want. And if that other people, if those other people happen to be addicted to the thing you want, it's really, really like you'll be in business forever, right? So the issue really is, if in this segregated society, if we created a drug haven, would that society be able to fend for itself? And chances are, if everyone's on drugs, they're not going to be very productive, so they'll just like run into decay. Because I mean, the problem with using Bitcoin for drugs is when it's interoperable with the cleared system, which is where you get to have the benefits of the functional society and still get the opportunity to lay about and be high, right? So, and that's a drag on the real economy, and that's not unfair for all the people who don't take drugs and go to work and are teachers and have to like be nurses, and you know, so that's really what we're talking about.
It's a bit unfair though as a dichotomy, don't you think? I mean, like, drug users are oftentimes productive people who on, you know, in the evening use drugs. They're nurses and teachers and journalists and Chris, who's addicted to heroin, and you know, me, who's addicted to cocaine. And, you know, probably you. And they're not necessarily just drags on society, right?
Well, it's like prohibition, right? So it's all about responsible values. So if a society can – that's why I say it'd be interesting to see the experiment. If a society can prove that it can use drugs responsibly and still take care of its base needs, then I don't see what the problem is. Everyone's responsible for themselves, right?
Isn't that what Portugal's doing?
Sorry?
Isn't Portugal doing exactly that?
I don't know about Portugal. Tell me.
They legalized drugs in what, 2001? Not legalized, but they decriminalized. And drug use has gone down. And they've, I assume, increased production. But, like, drug use has gone down largely. It's been a weird experiment over the last 10 years, 15 years, basically, just proving, or at least showing, at least in that society. Oftentimes people criticize it because they're a far less heterogeneous population than, like, the United States. But even in spite of that, like, you look at the results there, you look at the results in America, in places like Colorado with legalization of weed, et cetera, results are not that different, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, this is a really complex question, and I don't think there is an obvious answer, and that's why I say an experimental zone would be quite interesting. But, like, sugar, to me, is a drug, right? And a sugar is, in some cases, a worse drug, and it's leading to obesity, and for me, it's as addictive, potentially, as you know, they've done experiments on mice. But that's a legal drug, and you see that the world is kind of adjusting and self correcting. We're now anti-sugar, and we're trying to encourage, you know, diets that don't include sugar and all that. So we kind of naturally create responsible behaviors to adjust for the bad behaviors. But sometimes they can take a lot of time to come about, and you don't necessarily see the long-term side effects until it's too late for a lot of people. So the question is, do you sacrifice this sort of guinea pig intermediary, you know, population that has to suffer from that, or do you put in rules and regulations on a nanny state basis? It's a very complex situation. But my issue with Bitcoin at the moment is that it tries to have its cake and eat it, which is, rather than, like, it would, if you lived on a segregated island and you saw the effects of long-term drug abuse on your society, you would have more of an inclination to clean yourself up than if you're living in an interoperable society with functional people who are kind of diluting that effect, so you don't see it. So this is my inclination. I just think it would take longer for you to self-improve your behaviors. But that, I don't know. I mean, I have no idea. And but I think Bitcoin is just dangerous.
Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say Bitcoin is only dangerous in so much as there is, because of this issue with non-transparency, we don't see the costs of the system as well as the benefits, right? So you see the benefits quite easily. You see the Bitcoin billionaires buying Tesla cars and blah, blah, blah. But you don't necessarily see the human cost of the system.
So there are some people who would say that Bitcoin itself would represent a broad-based index of the dark markets online, and that if one wanted to invest in those markets, they could invest in Bitcoin to do so. Do you think that's a fair characterization, or do you think that's overly simple and absurd?
No, I think that's probably fair. I mean, I also think of it as a luxury good, because I think it's a luxury to be able to take drugs all day and not go to work. It's a luxury to be able to get, like, free returns from a Ponzi scheme. It's a luxury to be able to have total privacy in this day and age, right?
Sure, and maybe even those things are externalities, by the way, that we often wonder about that.
They almost certainly are. And that's why the government controls that so much.
I mean, perhaps, but I still see it as a luxury item. And in terms of economic efficiency, it is never going to be as efficient as a trusted network. Trusted network is always going to be more efficient than Bitcoin. So you can have that network, by all means go and do it, but adjust for the fact that it's a luxury item. And I always hear from technologists, oh, Moore's Law, right? But Moore's Law is relative, right? So any centralized system is going to benefit from Moore's Law as much as Bitcoin.
Well, economies of scale as well. I totally agree with that. I see Bitcoin serving basically the underserviced. I mean, that's where its niche is. It's not efficient in any other way. It's also the reason why I think that these bank blockchains are laughable, but we talked about that already. So I'd like to wrap the interview up, but are you a believer in gold? I'd be curious to know that.
No, I mean, I have gold jewelry, but for sentimental reasons, but I think gold is equally, again, it's a luxury item because it represents a unit of value that is totally selfish. It's like, I'm not going to share my gold. I'm not going to rehypothecate it. I'm not going to reuse it. This is my value. And even though value depreciates, if I was a farmer, I couldn't store my apple crop for 20 years because it would go off, right? But if I can transform it into gold and not do any more work, then I kind of presume that in 20 years' time, I should have the same economic rights, even though my Apple stock has totally depreciated in that time. And I never shared it with anyone, by the way. So it's kind of the ultimate Scrooge McDuck. And that's why it's a luxury, because that's why it's comparable in some ways to Bitcoin, I think.
Can we hit very specifically on your Bitcoin criticisms? Can you take us through a couple of them? We probably end up disagreeing on the conclusion, but I think a lot of times you make some really good points about the Bitcoin ecosystem that need to at least be heard, and we would love to give you a little pushback as well.
Sure. So my main criticism is the absolutism of the community and the idea that they have solved all the social ails of society with by introducing a really energy intensive, massively distributed ledger. And my point to that, my real point to that is that actually it's more like Animal Farm. And what we see happening is that over time, it's like it's very nice. It's that kind of utopian vision of the young teenager who thinks he can change the world, and then actually wakes up to reality that there's responsibilities in the world. And oh look, we in the banking sector do this for a reason, because if you don't do this, there are these other issues, and maybe there's an issue of scale here, and maybe there's an issue. And so as it matures, it becomes like the sort of increasingly cynical-minded adult who's like, frack, you know, here I was thinking that I could save the world, and actually I'm just on the cog like everybody else. So it's Animal Farm, and it's this idea that in the interim period, whilst these cycles are churning, there are people who know full well that there are issues, and they exploit the vulnerable minded through this process. So it's like, it's just like with communism, when you ended up preaching this idea of a utopian society, and then behind the scenes, you were all doing exactly what the capitalists were doing and not changing any of those processes and exploiting the, you know, people who were building the windmills.
That's all very fair. I don't even disagree with most of that. But, you know, what's interesting to me is as I hear you talk, you have a lot of, like, morality and ethics in your opinions. I don't have any of that. Which I don't know if that leaves a bad taste in your mouth, but I try to come at this from a point of like science more so than perhaps making the world a better place. And I don't know if you agree with that morality or ethical background. Do you think that's like one of your motivations in analyzing things?
I mean, I try to be logical. I try to think, you know, I think morality is a fundamental part of capitalism. If without morality, I don't think you can have functional capitalism. So I think capitalism works best when all the agents have moral sort of standards. And when people have moral standards, you have capitalism can do great good for everybody. But if you take them away, then it becomes a sort of negative feedback loop of hell. So I think it's hard for me to... And it comes down to social engineering in so much as... You have to share this planet with other people. You can never have full liberty, right? Because you have to interact in the public public space with other people. And at some point, someone else is going to infringe on your liberty to do this or that just by his general existence, right? You might just not like Donald Trump, right? You'd rather have a world where he doesn't come up on your TV screen. So there's always going to be intrusion into your little safe space. So the question is, how do we create protocols of interaction that we all agree on that aren't always going to be perfect, they're not going to suit everybody, but they please most of the people most of the time, and there is an active discourse in some way that allows us to change and upgrade those protocols. By the way, you know, I see the amendments to your constitution as like version 2, version 3 of any code, you know. So it's just about the dynamic inbuilt optionality to rebuild those, you know, jargony words, but you know, those social norms.
Sir,
so I think ethics does come into it, basically. Sorry,
are you
to
of
be
the,
long-winded.
Oh, that's fine. Long-winded is fine. Are you? We are long-winded all the time. Are you of the opinion then that like that Bitcoin is sort of a like, I don't know, a social reset? Is that what
Yeah. That's kind of what I think it is. I think it's actually going backwards in time to before the Industrial Revolution, before even the Italian Renaissance, where everyone had to be a jack of, you know, you have to fend for yourself. Bitcoin works best for people who know how the process works, who are really like fully alert to all the different coding issues and, you know, can spend their lives on Bitcoin forums, etc. So then it serves you brilliantly. But as a consumer who actually has to have a day job going to work or doing this and that, I don't have the time to keep up with the latest, you know, things that are happening. So I have to trust someone. And I would just conclude on the point that trust is inherent to society, to civilization, because You know, from the if you go to McDonald's or if you go to on a plane, you're putting your trust in someone else's division of labor. Someone else had to, like, almost when you look around you, everything that is sitting around you has a component of somebody else's labor in it. And you have to trust that they didn't spit in your food and that they didn't, you know, do all these different things. So you, so for the idea that you can take trust out of money, but not from the social system, you know, I think we need to be realistic, which is that you're never going to have a trustless system, and that's a bit of a utopia.
Well, I get that. In fact, you know, people don't realize, but gold itself, at least the way I see it, relies on trust. So you have to trust that this gold will work elsewhere. You could have, in some alternate history, have found a gold bar that you took to an island and the indigenous tribe just didn't use it, you know? So,
like, or that it's real gold and not filled with tungsten.
That as well, yeah. So, no, I don't disagree with that. I think for me, I find Bitcoin serving utility. I see that it's actually providing a market with service, and for me, it's hard to deny that that's what's happening. And so from there, I try to explain the community around it, and it gets weird. It gets totally weird. So I get your apprehensions. I mean, look, here's the thing. A lot of those 16-year-olds, despite what they say about wanting to change the world, they want to get rich, and it's vulgar, and it's it's obvious. So, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric in the Bitcoin community there as well.
And in fact, Isabella, you wrote that article about Mike Hearn being the reasonable one here.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, this entire block size debate, in my opinion, is about people wanting to get rich, right? There's this lie that there's a million people standing at the gates waiting to get into Bitcoin and just can't because they can't, like, use it because of the block size, right? When the reality is the millions of people that Bitcoiners want to come don't even know what Bitcoin is yet, or maybe never will, like my mom and dad, right? Those people just aren't going to find utility in this, at least not right now. So the question is this at the beginning of, like, the internet, how that was, you know, the internet was for porn and still largely is, but it also provides functional utility elsewhere, or is Bitcoin never going to provide utility to those people? And that's kind of the debate. But to me, Mike Hearn's complaint is that he wasn't going to get rich. And that to me is not reasonable.
He struck me as a reasonable chap when I met him. He seemed very articulate, very, you know, he wasn't sort of foaming at the mouth and sprouting all sorts of very ideological, kind of polemical, you know, rhetoric. So that's what I meant. With respect to him selling out and all that, I mean, I think that's equally, yeah, I agree with you. I think going from Bitcoin, where at least you could pretend you're trying to save the world, to a completely commercial enterprise is, you know, I agree with you. But then I think commercial enterprise is also good, because not in that sense, because I agree with you, blockchain I'm not a fan of, but I don't think we should not commercial enterprise because it does good things.
So my final question, I know Chris is running out low on battery, so we kind of have to start wrapping up, but what is there anything that would make you like Bitcoin? Is there anything that would make you think that it works? Like, what would your criterion be for changing your mind there? Would it even be possible? Or do you just know that this is a stupid, retarded project?
Look, I said at the beginning that I'm anti-absolutism, so I would never be so bold as to say, you know, never, because that would be silly. But I strongly suspect that the issue is one of economic efficiency, and I don't think that a society that opts to use Bitcoin over just basic trust and value system is ever going to be as prosperous as one that does use Bitcoin, and that's why I critique it. But in terms of relative systems, I think it all comes down fundamentally to what you consider a value system, and value is in the perspective of the holder, right?
Value, so yeah.
The beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Value is in the eye of the beholder. Yes, certainly.
But But it is. It's subjective. So what you value is not what I value, and what he values, right. You know, Chris values, whatever that dude, correct. We all value different things. We're never going to agree on what value is. So, I think we just...
Why do you spend time? Why do you spend so much time thinking about Bitcoin if it's something you think will fail?
Because I find it. I think it's a fascinating exercise in going through the financial system. So one of the things I loved when I was at college and at Reuters even was going through the emerging states, like how you go from this primitive society into a more mature society and blah blah blah. And I see Bitcoin like a petri dish. It's like a little experiment. You know, I said I want to see this island where, or, you know, because that's what I'm almost anthropological about it in many ways.
Fair enough. Excellent. Despite how people feel about Bitcoin, it is a fascinating experiment. If this thing died tomorrow, I could feel completely satisfied having been a part of it for that reason alone.
We've learned so much over the years, and I don't know that we would have learned any of this had we not gone into Bitcoin. And I think we've asked questions that we didn't know we could even – that we even needed to ask or that we could ask. So that
I think
that
it's been an excellent – yeah, absolutely. It's been an excellent educational tool, I think, for getting a certain part of the population to learn about these things. And so you said, is there anything good about Bitcoin? That is what is good about Bitcoin. It encourages people to exercise their minds about this sort of stuff.
So, Isabella, can we set a date maybe a year in the future here? And revisit this, and we'll see who's more right by that point. Maybe you've changed your mind. Maybe we've changed ours. Maybe we're butt coiners. Maybe you're Bitcoiner. Maybe we flip flopped. I don't know.
Yeah, sure. Why not? We can come back and see what's. And we can also check in on Mavrodi.
Yeah. Maybe Chris and I are so rich by that time because Bitcoin's gone moon.
Yeah, you might even be on the moon.
We'll be millionaires, multi-millionaires, because that's why we're here. Just kidding. Okay.
Isabella,
Isabella.
Isabella, where can people find out more about you? Do you have a Twitter handle you want to promote or a website?
I'm on FT Alphaville and at the Financial Times, which is free, even though it has a registration gate. And I'm on at Iza Kaminska, IzaKaminska on Twitter. But please, if you're going to be mean, I don't mind you being mean, but can we just be polite? Thanks.
So I think that that's a pretty great discussion. I think it's a great starting point for other discussions, which we'll probably have on the show at some point.
You've talked about that. We've talked about this. Like her contentions aren't entirely valid necessarily. You think at least? I actually tend to agree. Like she's got a lot of like stuff that is a little bit fuddy, frankly.
Well, on the Bitcoin side, I think I agree with you. But on the blockchain side, and really that's what we discussed a lot. I think she's like 100% right there.
Yeah.
I don't think so. And on the Bitcoin side.
I think a lot of her contentions with Bitcoin have more to do with, like, I think she just has this, like, belief of sort of, like, a rebooting of society or something like that, which is just not something that I care that much about.
Look, there's a couple ways I can express this. There's a lot of very, appropriate people in the space of finance who have very little exposure to the world of the underserviced. So from you and my perspective, we see a lot of the underserved.
Right, yeah.
And so we're able to see this in a way that they can't see it,
mm-hmm.
and vice versa. So in a lot of respects, I think they don't realize that Bitcoin provides utility to the underserviced, and in the ways that we were reporting that it does, I think they're kind of blocking it out
It's true.
So
it's the unreal transaction thing.
It goes exactly back to the unreal transactions. Are they, in fact, real unreal transactions, or are they actually unreal transactions?
Are they fake unreal transactions, or what?
Right.
Yeah, no, that's true. But you know, she like I said, she brings up a lot of good concerns. And frankly, like, it's hard. You know, I used to say that we are here 5 years in, or we are here 4 years in, or we are here 6 years in, depending on what year it was. And I use that as like sort of the indication that like this is working. What are they going to say in 10 years? You know. But you know what? The reality is, I think that you and I have been saying this a lot lately. No, we are not owed a working blockchain. The universe doesn't owe it to us. We don't know where this is going.
Correct. And I don't think that's understood by most in the banking community right now. But you know what? Let's save a lot of that discussion for next week. We'll probably have a lot of wrap up on this discussion. And in the meantime, if you're kind of new to the show, check out the Eugene Fama interview. That was some pretty good high level stuff there. He certainly had some criticisms about Bitcoin specifically, but I thought that it was a really good discussion to have as well, along the same vein.
That's actually how we got Isabella on. Frankly, she heard that originally, and she engaged with us. So we're really glad to have her on. We hope that you like the interview as much as we did, frankly.
Most of our episodes are not like this, but you know what? Subscribe to us on...
Lately they have been.
Lately they have been, that's true. Yeah, well, subscribe to us on Stitcher or on iTunes if you want to hear this on the regular.
And if you want to reach out to me, I'm DeRoseTech on Twitter.
Talk to Chris, don't talk to me.
And that's out. Peace out, party people.
And this is Johnson's chunking up the deuce of the South. The mass has ended. Go in peace.